Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mindscape Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Carroll, and today we are going to hell. I'm sure that some listeners, or at least some people who know about the podcast, have long been convinced that I personally am going to hell, but today we'll take a slightly more academic, or at least scholarly, look at the idea of what hell is, where it came from, why it came to be, what's supposed to be going on there, what people think about it right now. Today's guest, Marc DeVilliers, is a Canadian writer. He's written nonfiction books about many different things, about history, about politics, about the environment, about ecology. And for whatever reason, he decided to become interested in the idea of hell. Now, let me be very, very clear, because I know we have a broad audience. This is a conversation between two people who are completely convinced that hell is not real, okay? We're not actually sitting down and wondering whether or not hell might really exist. We both kind of take for granted that it doesn't. And I know that not everyone agrees with that, so apologies if we're not speaking to you about this issue. But from the point of view of someone who doesn't believe in hell, the fact that so many people do is fascinating, right? Why did we invent this? Like, what was it about human nature that made us think that there should be a place where you went to suffer eternal torment if you were bad? That's a very, very dramatic kind of thing. And it's not as if, even in the modern world, belief in hell is restricted to 2% of extremist people. Most people in the United States believe that hell is real. Most religions, whether it's not just Christianity, but also Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, most religions in one form or another have something we would recognize as hell. For that matter, polytheistic religions, pagan religions, long before monotheistic religion came on the scene, had this kind of idea. So what brought that about? What does it tell us about human beings? And of course, you know, it's fun to think about the psychology, the history, the sociology, but there's also a lot of wonderful little details, anecdotes, stories, right? Because hell is a great place to place a story. As we mentioned in the podcast, Dante's Inferno is a much more compelling and popular story than Dante's Paradiso is. Hell is just kind of a more interesting, compelling place than heaven is, even if you want to go to heaven and not to hell. All right, so we're going to learn a lot about that. I learned a lot from this. You know, as much as I'm not personally religious, the history of religious thought, I think, is both fascinating and important because it really does tell us something about human beings and how they perceive of their own place in the wider cosmos. So let's go. We're all driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. You can ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. And Mindscape listeners will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get their jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Mindscape. Just go to Indeed.com/Mindscape right now and support the show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Mindscape. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Marc DeVilliers, welcome to the Mindscape Podcast.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
This is certainly one of, in my opinion, one of those fun topics that we're going to be talking about here, the nature, the origin, the present status of hell, hell and damnation. What inspired you to write a book about this topic?
Well, I'm fascinated by the association between people who are articulate and sensible and the views that they nevertheless are able to hold. I mean, my favorite example was, I did write it, put it in the book, was Galileo, who has a reputation in our world anyway as being a scientist in rebellion against obscurity, obscurantism. And yet he spent quite a long while calculating how far beneath the surface hell would be based on the notion of Dante's that that Satan's navel is the actual center of the earth and the presumed size of Satan. And he calculated that hell is therefore, the dome of hell is therefore 650 kilometers beneath the surface of the earth. And he announced these findings in great triumph to an audience of clerics. And wow. there he is, an eminent scientist, but nevertheless, he was able to hold these kind of bizarre and contradictory beliefs in his head at the same time. So that's what interested me most about it, I think, at first. Anyway.
I didn't know that about Galileo. I knew similar things about Isaac Newton. He spent a lot of time on biblical exegesis later in life and so forth.
Newton was another great scientist who had some completely lunatic ideas, but that's not that uncommon.
It's not that uncommon. In fact, when you're talking about Galileo, it reminds me, you know, there's probably plenty of work being done in modern science, which is of the form, if you believe this thing, then let's see the consequences of it. But the thing that you're believing will later be seen down in the future history to be completely silly.
Yes, I think that's true. So, but, you know, then in our era, of course, people are just as credulous and just as conflicted as they were then. I mean, I read this morning that Joe Biden was now a secret jihadist who's plotting to take over the government of the U.S.
I didn't know that. Was that part of his new platform?
Yeah. It's not part of his press release, but you know, they are conspiratorial theorists who can believe almost anything.
Yeah, and it is a fascinating thing. That was why the very first episode of Mindscape that I did was with Carol Tavris, a social psychologist, and we talked about how people can justify their untrue beliefs. But today we're talking about what some of the subjects of those beliefs are. So I do want to get, you know, into the origin story of hell and so forth, but let's just get our bearings with a quick survey of the present situation. Like, how many people believe in hell? Is it universal among religions, or are there some exceptions?
Almost all religions have a hell or many hells. And some of the Burmese hells, for example, there are 40,040 hells in Burmese Buddhism. One for each sin. And obviously, some of those sins are going to be fairly trivial because, I mean, for example, borrowing books and not giving them back, pretending you've lost them, has its own hell.
Which I find absolutely
reasonable. But, you know, people who lie about the ages when they get married has its own hell. People who throw broken pottery over fences has its own hell. And there seems, in Chinese Buddhism, it seems a little unfair, but people with irregular teeth have their own hell too, which seems really unfair.
That does seem unfair. Well, unless it's their own fault for bad dental hygiene.
Well, that's true. I mean, it reminds me of the story from the New Testament where Jesus kept casting out demons from people, and there were a lot of demons in the New Testament. Jesus' homeland seemed absolutely thick on the ground with demons. And at least once, as we know, the Gadarene swine, he cast these demons out into poor pigs, which seems, again, really unfair, and would certainly get Peter on his case these days.
What did the pigs ever do?
Animal cruelty people.
Yeah. So good. Almost all religions have it. Are the individual, just today, just again to get our bearings, are most religious believers buying into this?
In the most recent Gallup poll, people who believed in religion in the United States had actually increased in the last decade or so from somewhere around 45 to somewhere around approaching 60%. More people, curiously, believed in hell than actually believe in heaven, which seemed to me an indication of this, of the peculiar nature of American politics at this time. In Canada, where I live, the belief in hell is less. 30 to 35% believe in hell, where almost everybody believes in heaven. So we're more optimistic.
We'll draw the conclusions that we can draw. Okay, so.
But generally in Europe, also, more people believe in hell than believe in heaven these days, which is, I find interesting.
So it's both sort of universal between religions, and at least a healthy fraction of people in all the religions actually buy into it. We're chuckling here at this belief, but this is very, very widely held.
Yes, it's very widely held, and it's interesting, and it's cross-religion. Almost every religion, with some exceptions, some interesting exceptions, believe in hell. And even those religions, such as most variants of Buddhism, which don't have a heaven, believe in hell. And some of the Buddhist hells are grotesque in their litany of punishments. There's some people, for example, the Hebrews and the modern Jews, they're not very good at hell. I mean, Jews are good at many things, presumably, but they're not very good at hell. Jewish hell is a really boring thing. Everybody goes to Sheol, and everybody, good or bad, evil or virtuous, they all go to the same place. And the Jewish faith is more interested in the here and now than in the afterworld, which I...
That's been my impression, that they don't have quite nearly the detailed picture of what comes after as Christians or Muslims do.
No, because there's no belief in the eternality of the soul, for one thing. So when you're dead, you're dead, and it's better to concentrate on the here and now than on where you might be after the candle is snuffed out.
Yeah. Well, so I really liked the part of your book where you talk about some of the origins of hell and more generally in the afterlife, right? It sort of crept up on us in some way. There was first some belief in that there was some kind of afterlife, and then it could have kind of got elaborated on as time went by.
I think where it started probably was in the early animist days, when people needed an explanation of why things didn't work. Mm-hmm. Why a perfectly competent hunter, fell and was killed by a perfectly normal and unaggressive animal. There had to be a reason for that. It just doesn't happen. And therefore, demons came into the equation as an explanation for things going wrong. So I think the second thread of hell was, it seemed that life became... It seemed to, particularly in urban, when civilization moved into the urban sphere, era, that life just seemed unfair, and it seemed that murderers and adulterers and embezzlers, who should be punished, seemed to prosper much more than seemed decent. And so you had to find some way of finding out a way to punish them when they were dead. It had to be after they were dead, because quite clearly nobody was punishing them while they were here.
Yeah.
So that's another way of inventing. That's another reason for hell. And I think the third thread of why people invented hell was as what former Episcopal Bishop Spong called a soul control, which is basically a way of imposing discipline on the adherents to your religion and threatening them with punishment when they didn't follow the injunctions of the hierarchy. So I think those three things together, in a more modern version of hell, they are slightly contradictory, because if it's a place of punishment and therefore Satan and the devil are agents of justice, or it's a way of sort of ordinary citizens sort of getting their own back, in which Satan is an agent of God in that sense.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, many of our religion, particularly Christianity, portrays Satan as the willful and rebellious angel of God called Lucifer, who is punished and banished and into the pit prepared for him. And so you have these contradictory things, where Satan is either a victim of his own hubris, as I put it in the book, he seemed to be an ambitious lad trying to take over the family business from Dad, who was the god, or he was an agent holding the evildoers to account, and the monotheisms have not really got this sorted out, the internal contradictions.
This episode of Mindscape is sponsored by BetterHelp. What's the first thing you would do if you had an extra hour in your day? Nap, go for a run, read a book? A lot of us ask these questions, wishing we had more time. But the question is, time for what? If you had unlimited time, how would you use it? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. And if you're thinking about therapy, BetterHelp is a great way to start. What I like about BetterHelp is it's so easy to start. It's entirely online. It's convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. So learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/mindscape today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/mindscape. Want to know one of my favorite sounds? Here it is. That's the sound I hear when I'm learning a new language with Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. Babbel is the science-based language learning app that actually works. Babbel is designed by real people for real conversations in a series of quick 10-minute lessons that are handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. I'm going to be traveling to France for the first time in a long time very soon, and Babbel's helped me reconnect with how to speak to merchants, how to order food, without having to consult a language app. Here's a special limited-time deal for Mindscape listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/mindscape. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/mindscape, spelled BABBEL.com/mindscape. Rules and restrictions may apply. Yeah, I mean, it's part of, there's a whole, we'll get into this, I think, but there are, once you have these supernatural beings with enormous power and you try to use them as explanatory agents, there are sorts of contradictions that you run into, right? And the devil being both useful to the cosmic battle and also, you know, an agent of mischief is definitely one of those.
Yeah, well, it's expressed when, you know, in many of the kind of establishment views of hell in Christianity, like Dante's, for example, most famous one, where Satan is at the innermost pit of hell, imprisoned in ice, and there for eternity, and yet somehow he is able to roam the universe, fomenting mischief and with malice aforethought. So how these two things play out is in most denominations elided, really, because they don't really want to think about the contradictions too much.
But the idea of hell as a punishment, I got the impression from your book that sort of was a later addition to the idea that there was an afterlife, right? In Greek mythology and so forth, there was still an afterlife, but it was not punitive in the same sense.
That's right. When it started, even going very early into civilization, the ancient Egyptians believed in an afterlife, and you had to, as it's predictable in Europe, in Egypt, you had to get there by floating down a river and crossing through gates and so on. But those who failed to make the cut, and there was a being called the Devourer of Souls, who was standing by to grab hold of those people who failed to prove their virtuousness. But he just devoured the soul. If you failed that test, if you were unable to pass the gates, you simply disappeared. There was no punishment. You were just dead. You were ended.
And what was the nature of the test? Was it a moral virtue test? Or
yes. Okay. There were judges who assessed how you had behaved during your lifetime.
Got it.
There were people who were exempt from this test, and those were the no surprise here, the priests, the caste, and the royal family. They didn't have to. They were automatically assumed to be virtuous.
Very clever, yeah.
Very nice hedge.
Well, that's
That same attitude was adopted by many of the later cultures, in the early Mesopotamian cultures, like the Ugaritic culture and the Canaanites, pretty much had the same thing. When you were dead, you went to a place prepared for you, but there was no punishment there. You were just there. And in most cases, after a while, you simply died. Mm. And the same thing was in the old African cultures, which I particularly am fond of, where you became if you were good, you became a revered ancestor. And if you didn't, to be forgotten by the living was hell enough. You were somebody dead then.
It's probably impossible to answer, but do people at least speculate about, you know, who was the first person to suggest that life continued after death? Or, you know, where did that idea pop up on the scene?
It's very early. But yeah. I mean, we know it goes back to at least 3000 BC in the ancient Egyptian cultures. The cult of Osiris was one of the earliest. And certainly that goes back quite. There's a lot of speculative evidence, speculations anyway, that the early Stone Age cultures, the hunter-gatherer cultures, also believed that you were able to survive death if you succeeded in a series of assigned tasks, and those tasks were dictated by your family and also your tribe and your clan. And so I think the notion that there was that you didn't die went back almost as early as the search for causality in the universe, as the search for the reason why things happened. There must have been a reason for something. There must have been a reason for thunder and with the gods stomping across the crowd. So it was a fairly short step from that to believing that there were supernatural beings, to believing that, well, under the right circumstances, we could join them.
Yeah. And I mean, certainly, so what's interesting there is that even before we officially had hell as distinct from heaven, we had this idea of judging, right? Like it's very clear that the whole setup is very much in response to human beings' desire to find reasons why things happen and justice and fairness in dealing with them somehow. If we can't do it here on Earth, let's say that the afterlife takes care of it.
That's right, exactly. And you have to rely on the judges to deeply know the inner lives of the souls who appeared before them. And they would know if you sinned during your life, and they would know how you sinned, and they would know whether you were repented, and they would judge you accordingly. And in the ancient Greek Hades, the mythology of Hades, there were three levels. There was the fields of Asphodel, which were everybody went while they waited for the judge, and then there was Elysium, which you went to if you were judged to be virtuous, and then there was Tartarus, which was the innermost pit and flames of hell and hellfire, and that's where it was from the Greeks who developed this notion that torture was very much a part of the afterlife. The Egyptians, they wouldn't need that. They sometimes in later dynasties in Egypt, people were cut up and flayed and boiled and minced and, you know, and skinned and everything. But it wasn't, the point wasn't punishment. The point was just to get you dead. But the Greeks the Greeks developed this into a much more systematic thing. And so, but even the Greeks didn't have it for eternity. You could probably, that was left to the Christians and the monotheisms to introduce the notion that hell was unending, that eternity was part of the formula.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I guess it makes sense. I hadn't realized that, but in this shift from polytheism to monotheism, a lot of things that were finite become infinite in some way, right? Like you had a bunch of flawed individuals being your gods in polytheism, and then everything is sort of perfect and everlasting up there in the sky or down below once you become monotheistic.
And in polytheism, they had these quarrelsome families of gods, and what happened to you could swerve and turn on its heel if a different god was prevailed on a different day.
Yeah.
So if the storm god was better than the god of agriculture, your crops failed. On the other hand, in some cases, the god of agriculture was able to put the storm god into a hole where he belonged, and your crops were wonderful. And so it was easy to explain why things went wrong, because this whatever happened, one god or other prevailed over another, and the quarrelsome families of gods were constantly at war with each other. And so that made sense when the ancient Hebrews invented the monotheism. it no longer made sense that because God was, it was infinitely able and infinitely everlasting, and he was therefore impossible for him to be wrong.
Yeah.
And therefore, what happened, what had to happen, is that we were wrong. We weren't worshiping him or adhering to his ways in the proper fashion, and therefore he was right to punish us. So, but it was not the God's fault anymore. It was our fault now.
And but nevertheless, there is some universality in the idea, right? I mean, so the Greeks came up with Tartarus. Tartarus was the place. Tantalus was a person, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Okay. But still, the Hindus, the Buddhists, I think the Japanese folk religion and so forth also came up with this idea that you would be treated badly afterward if you were bad in, yes, in, while you were alive.
Well, both the Hindu and the Buddhist traditions, the hell was not open-ended for obvious reasons, because the reason you went there was not for punishment. The reason you were sent there was to work through the sins that you committed in life, and once you had purged those from your system, and the best way of purging them was to be tortured for a millennia, and that would certainly drive all thoughts of sin out of your mind, I would think, after a short while, but you were then released on parole. You were let out to start your life again, and this could last for a very long time. In the Hindu traditions, the time you spent in hell varied from somewhere like 400 to 500,000 years to several million. It must have seemed like eternity to those people who were consigned there, but it wasn't forever.
Right.
And the same with the Buddhist traditions. There was an old tradition in Tibetan Buddhism, for example, where a mountain of sesame seeds, 100 miles on a side, a cube, one small bird took one seed away every 1,000 years. And when that mountain had disappeared, then you were deemed to have purged your sins and you could be released.
Well, okay, this brings up a question I'm definitely going to ask. I'll just get out of the way right now. I mean, how do they come up with this specific idea? You know, it's someone had to invent that at some point. And do you think that they knew they were just inventing it, or did they think that they were working it out, or did they think that there was a revelation?
I think this remains a mystery, because it's the same level of credulity that we still face with now when we face with the supernatural. They had to be, stories started and then they became embellished, and one monastery was competing with another, and one monk was telling tales that were more up to date and more modern and more lurid than the previous monk. And I think there was a competitiveness in what we would now call, I said, fake news, that they outdid each other with, but nobody knows who actually invented these. I mean, Buddha himself simply accepted them as real, and he had a long listing of the tortures, a rather enthusiastic listing of the tortures to which sinners would be subjected. But he also, like all of his followers, believed that in the end karma would prevail, and you would be able to work your way through your sins and purify yourself, and then you would be bathed in the river of forgetfulness, and you would start the whole process again. And that could where, but where the endless numbers of millennia came from, I think they were just, there was a Japanese monk called Genshin who had, as I suggested in the book, only a hazy idea of cosmological time, who suggested that 10 trillion years might be about right for the average sinner to escape. And nobody, as far as I know, has topped that.
Well, get some cosmologists on the scene. I think we can top that. But I mean, I also wonder whether the audience for these stories at the time didn't take them seriously, right? Like, okay, sesame seeds, et cetera. Now we are imagining that it was doctrine handed down from on high, but at the time it was just a fun story.
I think both of those aspects are correct. I think it was a story that they could be thrilled with. And also it was a way of inculcating in people who succeeded them, their children and their families, a way of threatening them with punishment if they didn't shape up.
Right.
And so I think both of those things happened. I think almost certainly nobody thought to himself, my God, if I don't behave now, I'm going to be in there for 2 trillion years. I don't think anybody actually thought. They just said, it's going to be sore.
Yeah, it's going to be bad.
Yeah, it's going to be bad, and the hellfire is going to get me, and the knives are going to cut me, and I'm going to be immersed in noxious and obscene liquids, and yeah, it's going to be bad, but I'll get out of it. And I think they definitely believed that something was going to happen. Yeah,
but so there were definitely stories being told, but there's also, I mean, some of those stories were stories about eyewitness testimony, right? There's a tradition of visiting hell. The ancient Greeks had Orpheus and so forth, right. And the Christians have their own story.
Aeneas was there. And if you look at the medieval period, which is where most of these most lurid imaginings of hell came from in Christianity, it seemed at one point virtually every literate monk or nun had either visited hell or had been vouchsafed hell in a vision or had talked to somebody who was there and could vouch for the veracity of everything. And the stories were actually remarkably similar. Not surprisingly, because they fed off each other. But pits, dark, gloomy pits, hellfire that gave off no light, fire that burned but didn't destroy. Hellfire couldn't destroy people because that would be beside the point. It would be over too soon.
Right.
So it had to burn you, but you couldn't die of it. And there was in some versions of some of the visions, the medieval visions of hell, there were very sharp beaked crows who were standing by to drag your entrails out through your anus. And there were lurid versions for sure. And, you think, okay, well, after a while, wouldn't you sort of run out?
But no, you only have so many entrails.
Apparently not. These systems were endlessly self-renewing, and that's part of the interesting and peculiar physics of the netherworld.
And if you can go visit, like as Aeneas and Orpheus and Virgil, maybe.
Yeah, Virgil.
It has to be located somewhere, right? I thought it was very funny in your book, like you go through like all the places where hell might be found. Like it wasn't nearly as conceptual as you might think of it today. You might actually find the entrance if you looked hard enough.
Oh yes, well the early Romans knew exactly where it was, just off Mount Etna, and there's a grotto there which gives off what are called mephitic gases, which are poisonous gases. And people had noticed that birds that flew past it or that cows had wandered into it keeled over dead. And so that obviously was a place where it was the anteroom to hell. And it was inhabited by one of the nastier Sibyls and Gorgons. And so that was one, but there were many others. There were one in Avernum. There was one in Greece. There was also one in Turkmenistan. As I said, a Johnny-come-lately hell it was thought to be beneath the Loch Derg in Ireland, because St. Patrick found it there and reported that he had been given a tour. And there are many others. There's one off the coast of the west side of the Gulf of Mexico. The Aztecs had an entrance to hell there. But a very popular one is in China, in the city of Chengdu, which was visited by numerous people. Governor Kuo of one of the provinces was lowered into it on a rope, and he spent a nice time in hell and was a was given a nice cup of tea while they explained the management of the system to him. And the city of Fangdu has been known actually for 1,500 years. It's been a repository of hellish law. The artisans of Fangdu are widely thought to be prosperous because they manufactured instruments of torture, which they then sold to the denizens of the underworld. And unfortunately, Fangdu was drowned in the rising of the waters of the Three Gorges Dam. So that, but they still have a theme park there, which you can visit if you're.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Well, I mean, I suppose. if hell's down there, why should we be surprised that there's multiple entrances to it, right? You know, I mean, it just makes things easier, a little bit more efficient, right?
And there's almost always a gate. It's a gated community,
yeah,
like heaven is generally. And you have to have Dante's famous injunction, you know, lose all hope, ye who pass through here. But almost all the ancient Egyptians had 7 gates. The Zoroastrians had 8, I think, if I recall correctly. And pretty well everybody had at least one gate you had to pass through. The legend of Ishtar descending into the underworld to visit her sister, she had to pass through 8 gates, and losing an item of clothing at every one, she was forced to appear before her sister, who was a thoroughly unpleasant goddess called Ereshkigal, who impaled Ishtar on a meat hook until the gods up above came and rescued her. So, they're always gates, and sometimes they're bridges you have to cross in order to get into hell.
Are these gates keeping people out or in?
They're always keeping people out, because when your time has come, you couldn't go. You couldn't enter hell until your time was ready, except Aeneas was able to go in, and of course Dante was able to use Virgil to get him in. So there were passwords you could use and people you could use that were able to get you in, but nobody ever tried to escape. It was you couldn't get out. No, that wasn't part of the plan.
It's interesting they would try to keep people out. I am very interested in how the specificity evolves. I mean, obviously, in someone like Dante, it becomes huge. But as you mentioned in the book, if you read the Jewish Bible, the Old Testament, there's almost no talk of hell or Satan or anything like that. And there's more of it in the New Testament and even more in the Quran. And so people definitely became more interested in the details along the way.
And I think as hell and Christianity became more embedded in the system, the further away from Christ we got, the more grotesque the punishments of hell became. But it wasn't really until the early medieval times when the church was beginning to face competition from early free thinkers and also later on, of course, from Calvin and Luther, and they were felt themselves to be under attack by people who were not as controllable as they should be. At that point, hell became even more severe, and Satan turned from an agent of God and a guardian of the dead into something evil and malevolent who would grasp you if you didn't behave, if you didn't adhere to the tenets of the church, if you didn't listen to your bishop, if you didn't follow the threads that they were told you to. And if you were a protester or Protestant, as it became later, then hellfire would get you for sure. And the closer, it's the same syndrome as the witch trials of Europe in the 17th and 18th century became more and more aggressive the more that the church felt itself under attack from dissenters. And so it's no wonder, for example, that Germany, where many of the early dissenters began, there were more witches burned and hanged in Germany than in any other place. So it's predictable that the hierarchy of the church exaggerated and made more appalling the punishments that awaited you if you didn't adhere to the proper way of doing things.
If we just stuck to the New Testament or even just to the Gospels, can we say anything about what the early church or what Jesus would have thought about hell? I mean, I think there's some debate, right, of whether Jesus was clear that you would go to hell.
Jesus had, in the Gospels, had very little to say about hell. There were a couple of things where Matthew quoted him as saying that, certain people would be consigned into the eternal flames. And Jesus was big on the kind of wailings and gnashings of teeth that went on down in hell. But he never said where it was, and he never said much about who went there and who didn't. Hell at that point was really, according to those stories, was really an imprisoning place for the opponents of God. And it was mostly Satan, not so much humans. And it was really only as the church grew in its stature and got further away from the writers of the gospel and the supposed sayings of Jesus himself, that they started to invent the more aggressive punishment that sinners would face if they didn't follow the Holy Church.
Jesus did talk about heaven quite a bit, right? And how you needed to go, through him to get through heaven. Yeah. And maybe it was just assumed that not getting into heaven meant you went to hell.
I think that was the assumption, and certainly the early church believed that anyone who was not didn't follow Jesus or was born before Jesus existed would automatically be consigned to hell. And in fact, one of the stories has Jesus doing these harrowing of hell, that is, visiting hell after he was crucified, or in some versions while he was still on the cross, going down to rescue people like Adam and the first people who were in hell because they came before him, but he got them out and he was able to get them out. So yeah, everybody who wasn't saved by Jesus would be automatically consigned to hell.
Yeah, I mean, this is a fascinating story to me. It comes into one of the sets of contradictions. Somehow in the history of religion, there are certain things you want to be true, and it might be difficult to make everything compatible with everything else. So the harrowing of hell story is right there in the gospel, or at least in one of, I forget which book it is.
Although there's no real detail. Most of the real stories about the harrowing of hell were from the apocryphal gospels or some of the Gnostic gospels.
Right.
For example, the Gospel of Nicodemus and Gospel of Bartholomew, which were rejected by the early church fathers and not incorporated into the canon. That's where most of the stories of the harrowing of hell came from. And there were also some early versions of the stories, which were in fact pre-hell, a thing called the Testimony of Truth, which is one of the Gnostic Gospels, had stood its whole tale of Adam and Eve and original sin on its head. And in that sense, the Gospel was very critical of God for grudging Adam and Eve knowledge. Why would he do that? What a malicious grudger he was, as the like the gospel put it. And in that case, the serpent or Satan was portrayed as the sensible, worldly person, and God was a kind of a peevish person, simply punishing people who didn't listen to him properly. So there was a lot of variance on that, but in the actual gospels that are in the New Testament, there's actually very little about hell.
I mean, maybe it's worth, for those who don't know about this whole story, maybe it's worth just talking a little bit about how what we now consider to be the scriptures came together, right? It wasn't like there was one very clean process by which either the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament we were just written down. There were like a whole bunch right. of documents floating around, and some councils had to decide what was in and what was out. But the people yeah. at the time, you know, might have read all of these stories, whether or not they went in or out.
They did. I think they probably did read many of them, and also the ancient prophets. Hebrew prophets were much more into apocalyptic visions than the Sanhedrin or the Hebrew authorities were. And a lot of those survived and were transmuted into stories that were picked up by the Christians. And also Christianity adopted freely from Zoroastrianism, which had a very well-developed dualistic theory of a universe that was in contention between the forces of virtue and the forces of evil.
And that was one of the first monotheistic religions that really caught on.
Yes, it was the first. It was the first multinational monotheistic religion, I think. And Christianity picked up a lot of its thoughts about hell from Zoroastrianism, from the Greek mythologies of Hades, from the stories of the tortures of Prometheus in having his liver pecked out for eternity by a vulture. And so... And these stories accreted as they went along, and then as the early few centuries of Christianity proceeded, they tended to agglomerate some of the earlier stories and accumulate them and embellish them. And by the time you got to the 7th and 8th century, the time of Charlemagne, for example, the visions of hell had become reasonably predictable, that there was beneath the earth, there were cauldrons of boiling oil, there was hellfire, there were demons with the pitchforks, and those were worked into almost all of the visions that followed in the next few centuries, except Satan, who became more and less a servant of God and more a creature of evil as we proceeded through the centuries.
Well, Satan's story is more complex, I think, than most people think. Certainly, it's more complex than I knew until yeah. I read your book. There is, for one thing, there's the idea of Hades, which was originally the person, and then it became a place with a person, and then there's co-bosses at different times, and Lucifer versus Satan and all that.
It gets very confusing because chronology is not simple.
Yeah.
Hades was, first of all, a place, and then, yes, Hades also became the god of the underworld. His brothers were Zeus and Poseidon, and he drew the short straw and drew the underworld, and it was always regarded as horrendous to look at and pitiless and monstrous, and which I argue in the book was a bit of a bum rap, because his brothers were just as bad. I mean, his family was not an exemplary family. His father, who fathered all these, one of the titans, Kronos, swallowed Hades and some of his siblings when they were infants. And Zeus, showing some of the leadership skills that made him a chief god later on, forced his father to vomit up the children and rescued them, and then the children banded together and prepared a pit for the titans and banished their father into this pit. And that was the earliest version of the underground place to store the bad guys.
Right. Family is always hard.
Family is always hard, yeah. And, you know, and so the early Christian hell, early versions of Christian hell, started in more or less the same way, as a revolt against God. Lucifer and his cohorts were rebellious, were not taking orders, and God, in a fit of anger, again sent the angel Gabriel to prepare a pit for Lucifer, which was basically borrowed holus bolus from the Greeks. Mm. It was the same story, just updated with new names. And that's where Satan came from. And he was abolished. If you listen to Milton and people from the traditions he borrowed, not only was Lucifer abolished, but about half the heavenly host went with him. So, as I said in the book, it doesn't show much for God's management skills that half of his crowd was a revolt against him. Anyway, so there they were. And so both the ancient Greek hell and our more modern hell started with a revolt in heaven. But Hades and Satan were often in many early Christian writings cohabiting or coexisting in hell. Hades was the ruler of hell and Satan was the prince of death. And sometimes they worked together and sometimes they didn't. And there was a fair amount of quarreling going on, and there was some there was one Gospel of Bartholomew was wonderful in this depicting the panic and the ineffectualness of both Satan and Hades when Jesus came down to rescue Adam, they kept blaming each other for inviting him down there in the first place. They seem more ineffectual old creatures than they do skillful evil managers of the dead.
But the early Christians thought that, like you said, both Satan and Hades were powerful figures in hell. As far as I can tell, Hades has disappeared from the official doctrine.
Hades disappeared. Sometimes he crops up as a name, Beelzebub.
Okay.
But that is, Beelzebub is derived from the Mesopotamian god Baal, who has also visited the hell to wrestle with death at some point. But it's very confusing because there's no consistency. Beelzebub is sometimes Hades, sometimes it's Lucifer himself. Hades was originally the master of hell and later on was consigned to a lesser role as a kind of innkeeper in chief. And after a while, he just vanished from the Roman religion was supplanted by Christianity, Hades and the other pantheon of the Greek gods disappeared became faded into the background.
Yes. And it's not even clear the relationship between Lucifer and Satan, is that right?
Well, no, I think it's pretty clear that Lucifer is Satan. Again, there are contradictions in the stories, and the other version of Satan is... Satan, as you probably know already, in Hebrew simply means adversary. It's the word for adversary, and he was originally one of the servants of God, and he was the one who goaded God into, for example, testing Lot with the boils that he was, and putting him through the trials of his faith. And it was Satan and God who cooked up this little scheme together.
Sorry, was it Lot or Job we're talking about?
Oh, Job. I'm sorry, Job. Job. Satan was really in the royal court. He was one of the children of God. So yes, he was also Lucifer, and he was Satan at the same time. And it was there were two quite separate views of how that developed. The Christians turned him into Satan, and lost Lucifer. And some of the early Christians thought, well, Lucifer could easily be redeemed. He wasn't so bad. He had a bad press. He could be saved. This was a minority view that was punished by exile and casting anathema on people like Origen, for example, who was an early Christian gadfly.
And one of these contradictions that you mentioned is the idea that in most of the stories, at least as they developed in the Christian telling, hell predates humankind. Is that right? Like the fall of Lucifer and so forth happened first, and it was, like
That's
you said,
right.
used as a prison for the bad angels and then repurposed, I guess, as a place to keep the bad people.
That's essentially what it was. And there was it was basically the what they call the innermost pit, which is where Satan and Lucifer, or Satan, a.k.a. Lucifer, and his cohort were imprisoned. And originally it was just a hole in the ground which God instructed Gabriel to heap sharp rocks on their head and keep them in down in there. So it was a pretty primitive arrangement, which is a pit with rocks. And that became much more embellished as time went on. And it didn't seem sufficient that there would be a, that Satan was just imprisoned in there with nothing much to do. And you needed somehow to deal with sinners. You needed some way to control their actions. You didn't want to let them enter into any more heresies than you could head off. And so, yes, it became, in your word, repurposed into a prison for malefactors and not just a prison for the chief, devil in chief. Yeah.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
I mean, the Christians certainly had a good time embellishing and complicating the notion of hell. Did Judaism not do that? I mean, it was not a big deal, certainly in the Old Testament times, but is there some tradition in Judaism also coming up with some stories about the afterlife?
As after the Babylonian captivity, as people returned to Israel, there were developments in this universal notion of Judaism that everybody just went to Sheol, and it was a place where there was no activity, there was nothing to eat, nothing to do, it was just dark and gloomy. And after a while, the same impulses came into the Judaic thought that somehow evildoers would prospering more than they should. And so Sheol became divided into two, a place for sinners and a place for the virtuous. And it was a fairly short, would be a fairly short step from there for the evildoers to be punished and the virtuous to be rewarded. And indeed, there were some streams in Judaism that believed, and to some degree, and some sectors still believe that there would be that when the Messiah comes and Abram is resurrected, that those virtuous would be accepted into a world which is a more bucolic and more paradisic, and the sinners would therefore just be forgotten and not killed and not tortured, but just forgotten.
Forgotten. Whereas on the other side of things, Islam comes along at a time when the idea of hell is already pretty fully developed. And as far as I can tell, they took to it enthusiastically.
Enthusiastically. And they have a number of rather inventive embellishments. The diet of hell is there's a particular root which, if you pour if you poured a drop of the sap onto the earth, it would poison all life on earth. Well, the sinners are forced to drink that, and of course they destroyed, and then they were resurrected immediately afterwards. Also, they were very good on Muhammad himself was very good on the ways that you could in fact torture people without them dying. Pouring incredibly hot boiling liquid on top of their heads, and then it would run through the body and pool out at their feet. That was one of his favorites. And then, of course, once it was out, you would be resurrected and the whole process would start all over again. So, but diet was much more an interesting facet of Islamic hell than I didn't see anything in anybody, Dante or anybody, who suggested what you might actually eat. Nobody got that far, but Islam was good on that.
And how much? Go ahead.
No, I mean, fire. The Christian fires still remain the hottest furnaces of all, but Islam used fire consistently, and mostly to burn off the skin. That was what they were interested in more. They weren't not much into mincing and cutting. Then that was left for the Buddhists to get into that sort of thing, and the Christians to get into boiling and oil. Mm. But they were like flaying was part of what Islamic thought would be appropriate punishment in hell.
And I would imagine that in any of these mature religions, there's both a set of stories and things that people tell each other, and then there's sort of the official doctrine. I mean, how much of the specific story of hell and, you know, who is the boss in it and who lives there and what happens to you there is embedded in, I don't know, I mean, the Catholics are probably the best at writing things down, right? But even so,
there's very little. It's not in the catechism, and it's not in the official doctrines of the Catholic Church, but in the writings of the Jesuits, of the writings of early bishops, Adamnan, for example, who was a famous Irish bishop of the seventh century. The embellishments came outside the canon, right, generally, they adopted from each other, they adapted from each other, and they embellished on each other and others' work. And very little was in the catechism of the Catholic Church itself does say that hell is an actual place where actual sinners go to be actually tortured, but they don't get into the specifics of it. That's left for the commentariat.
And wasn't there a rumor going around that Pope Francis had mentioned to an interviewer that maybe hell wasn't in fact literal that way?
But I think the Catholic Church has backed away from this. I mean, it's still in the catechism, but Francis, for example, said that hell is simply a radical separation from God, which is a much more intellectual and not physical version of punishment.
Not so much burning there.
No, it was self-torture in a sense. The Vatican rapidly backpedaled when he was quoted as saying this to an Italian journalist. But it wouldn't have surprised anybody if he had said it. The hierarchy is skeptical of the literal interpretations of gospel these days, and they view it should be interpreted to some degree as a metaphor, as some degree as an explanation, but not to be taken as literally as it used to be taken. I think that's quite common in the Catholic Church.
Yeah,
even now.
So I did. I actually did research for this podcast interview. That is to say, I went onto Google and I asked what the current beliefs were. It's easy to find, you know, opinion polls, at least in the U.S. Worldwide, it's probably a different story. But what I found was that right now, 72% of Americans believe in heaven. It's maybe falling very, very slowly, but it's not significant. 58% are believing in hell, and that's been consistent for at least 10 years, but I think it is higher than it used to be. And interestingly, so 58% of Americans believe in hell, but among American Buddhists, it's 32%. Among American Hindus, it's 28%. And among Americans who don't have a religious affiliation, it's 27%.
So that's the astonishing thing. You can believe in hell even if you're not religious.
Yeah, it certainly serves some purpose there.
Because it's very convenient. It's a convenient concept to have a hell, because it explains so much.
Well, and 70% of Americans believe in Satan, and that is apparently up from only 55% a couple decades ago. For whatever reason, belief in Satan is skyrocketing in the United States.
People who look around and see what's going on in the country believe that some malevolent force must have a hand in it. Otherwise, why would everything be so crazy? It's got to be some explanation, some reason for it. And Satan, even if you don't believe in hell, Satan is a malevolent force patrolling the universe. He doesn't necessarily have to have a home,
right?
But he is a force that's a countervailing force to the positive force of whatever you call it, God, Jesus, spiritualism, Buddha, Yama, whatever your particular religion
I was trying to figure out whether I should be surprised, whether it's easier to believe in hell without Satan or to believe in Satan without hell. Probably it's easier to believe in Satan without hell.
I would think so, because hell is such, there's so much specific detail about what it is, what it looked like, what the meteorology is like, you know, what the topography is like, and the imps and demons that run it have to have a hierarchy. It's a very complicated thing, where Satan just is a malicious spirit who can be manifest anywhere and at any time in any person. So yeah, I think it's much easier to believe in the devil than it is to believe in his abode.
And believing in Satan certainly does help, you know, make monotheism a little bit more consistent with our experience of the world, right? If there were just a single omnipotent, benevolent God and no other powerful supernatural creatures, he has a lot of explaining to do.
Well, it's one of the difficulties of monotheisms and difficulties of believing in a universal, loving, and just God is the explanation for evil, and therefore Satan is a very convenient explanation for that. It's never quite worked out why an all-powerful, all-seeing, and all-omnipotent God has allowed the force of evil and the force of evil to appear. And to compete with them, the theory is that in a sense, Satan is God's creation because it helps to impose discipline and explain things that God himself is unable to do. And so he's acting as God's agent in that sense.
Yeah, so just letting some of my personal opinions leak in here. I'm sure I've been doing it the whole hour, but I'll do it even more explicitly here. Yes, there's the problem of evil in religion. If God is good and omnipotent, why is there evil in the world? And like so many other attempts to answer these conundrums in the context of religious belief, the idea that, well, there's also Satan, and that helps explain the existence of evil seems more like a deferral than a solution, right? Well, because so then why is there Satan?
it doesn't explain anything. The explanation is just at one step removed. Why Satan causes it, but what caused Satan? It's the same argument when people argue for the existence of God. There has to be a God because who caused the universe? Well, then you argue who caused God.
Exactly.
But
yeah.
If evil exists, what caused evil? Well, Satan caused evil. Why does Satan exist? Because God caused Satan.
Yeah.
And there must be a reason why God did that. And the reason is there evil happens anyway, and it seems that God is not as omnipotent and all powerful as the doctrine would suggest.
So I think one of the reasons why we came in contact is because you wrote this book and I provided a blurb for it. And that's because I was quoted in it. And the reason why I was quoted in it is because there was a discussion started by a New York Times column by Ross Douthat, where he is making the argument, which he's not the first to make, that without the notion of hell, there's no reason to be a good person. Without the concept of punishment afterward, anything goes and that's bad.
Yes, I think it's quite common. And that's a very condescending view of human life, it seems to me, because if you automatically going to be evil, unless there's a controlling force that forces you to be good, it doesn't say much for your spiritual development. It doesn't say much for your personality. It doesn't say much for your society in which you're embedded. And it seems that why should people automatically choose to do bad things if there's not a control over their activities? It seems that. You know, why do people like Ross Douthat think that you're going to automatically be evil if you're not forced to be good? Why, if you're a good Christian and you're religion, you believe in a God, why couldn't the reverse be true? Why couldn't you be good unless you're being forced to be evil? But they don't seem to confront that. They seem to doubt that you need the punishments of hell in order to be kind of bullied into line in order to do the right thing. And that seemed to be a very condescending view of humanity.
Yeah, I worry that I'm being ungenerous here because I'm, you know, commenting on people who I disagree with. But it seems worse than ungenerous to me. It seems horrifying, the idea that without this eternal damnation in this particular case, there's no reason to be a good person. And that makes me think, like, really? You can't think of any other reasons to be a good person other than that?
Because if you confess to be an atheist, and if you're in impolite or even polite company, people will say, "Well, how? Why are you doing good then? Why didn't you just go and murder somebody? Because you don't have to worry about any punishment in the afterlife." Well, I most people don't want to murder people. It's just they just.
I like to think that, yeah.
No, I think, the thing I liked about your quote in your essay against doubt was, why is there no concept of parole? Your life is only 80 years, but your punishment is eternal? It just seems disproportionate.
Well, it does, and I think that even more, even for heaven, the same argument goes. I think that the people who come up with these ideas, their imaginations, we're all finite human beings, it's just very hard to stretch our imaginations to truly embrace infinity or eternity in that way. How can you even be happy and content in heaven for infinity years is something I don't quite understand.
I did a very brief chapter as a detour to heaven, but there's the writings, the historical writings on hell are much more interesting and comprehensive than the writings on heaven, which are few and banal at its best. And I kept coming across this description of heaven as a throne of God surrounded by holy angels singing, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord our God," day and night, forever. I mean, they used to say the devil has the best music, but he also has a much better story to tell than that.
I mean, everyone agrees that the Inferno is much more interesting to read than the Paradiso, right? When it comes to Dante, it is. I think it's a broader thing going on, which is that human beings tend to underrate the extent to which life is about change and process, right? They think there's something perfectible about life, and this, whether you're Buddhist or Catholic or whatever, and the idea is to reach that perfect state and stay there. And I think that, you know, as a naturalist myself, accepting that life is about flux and change and impermanence is a much more grounded, realistic way to go.
And yet most religions are believers in perfectibility. I mean, even those who do not have an eternal punishment and don't have a heaven, the idea is to work your way through various incarnations until you have completely purged yourself of bad doing, and then you have become one with the universe, and you have become perfectible, and there's nowhere else to go. Right. The religions don't really get into what happens then, because there is really no then there. There's no way to go. Once you're perfectible, then what?
Yeah. And so I guess as one final thought from my side, it's interesting you say talking about being an atheist in polite company, because there is such a thing. There is an idea of what polite company is, right? We get it on TV and in the media, and there's certain ideas that are taken for granted, and both sides of any one debate complain that their extremist view is not represented in polite company. I do think that, you know, the sort of media approved version of what is polite and okay says that being atheist is worse than being religious, but it also says you shouldn't be really religious, right? I mean, it would mock you if you believed too directly in Satan, hell, and demonic possession, even though most people do believe that.
I think fundamentalism in that sense is not polite company itself, yes. I think people do not like extreme positions. I think social compromises are necessary. But I still think it's more acceptable to be slightly religious than it is to be slightly unreligious.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Although I think that's changing pretty quickly. I don't know. The newer generations seem to be retreating fairly rapidly from at least from the organized church, if not from spirituality itself.
Well, the great thing about polite company is that it reverses itself all the time and pretends it never has, right?
Oh, yeah, and it does. That's a universal change. You're right. That's
That's right.
That's where we go.
So I do, you know, I'm pretty optimistic. I'm pretty, I don't know, maybe optimistic is a sense of prediction, but I'm interested in the fact that people who don't have any religious affiliation are growing as a set of people. But I've learned now from looking at things from your book that the set of people who believe in Satan is also increasing dramatically. So I'm going to have to try to understand that better. That's a little concerning to me.
Yeah. And the notion that exorcisms have been returning to popular culture is an interesting thing to me, because demonic possession, it's not necessarily Satan, but it's there are people who certainly believe in that. And I was fascinated to learn that you could actually now book an exorcist online. There are a number of them available for freelance exorcisms, and their business seems to be flourishing.
Well, part of me has respect for that. Like, if you believe in Satan and devils and demons, and then why not believe that they possess people and you should get them exercised? It's almost worse to me if you sort of profess belief in that, but not really, right? I like consistency in my ontology.
Also, if you profess belief and then believe that it's impossible to change and get rid of them, that would be even more depressing.
That would be depressing, yeah. All right. But so it's a mixed message here. But Mark de Villiers, thanks so much for being on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Sean.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.